You're tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. I'm Kenny Shook.
And this movement, after declaring, for example, Basta, the Zapatistas, it has now declared that another world is possible. This is work in progress, as our values, our goals, our policies and strategies are being worked out. And as the book Alternatives points out, they're not being worked out in some green room in Geneva or in Washington, D.C. or Brussels, but on day-to-day basis by groups and communities and people around the world.
People's Tribune Radio is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publishes the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Ordering and contact information will be provided after the show. On January 10, 2005, the International Forum of Globalization launched the second edition of the book Alternatives to Economic Globalization. Today, narrator and producer Carolyn Crane shares with you the exciting material recorded in Cal Theater at Fort Mason Center in San Francisco, California. Carolyn?
In the next half hour, you'll hear excerpts from talks given by three speakers. First, Antonia Yuhas, project director for the IFG, and winner of a 2004 Project Censored Award for her reportage on the economic occupation of Iraq, talks about her findings.
First, we have potentially an election coming up in Iraq on January the 30th. Now, I am afraid that this election is actually going to go forward, and I think it's going to be a horrendous bloodbath. However, I do think the Bush administration is pretty committed to seeing it go through. Many people are confused at why the Bush administration wants to see this election go through, particularly given that it looks like, while it will be a government that will certainly be friendly to U.S. interests, it's not going to be nearly as friendly as this current government, which we literally handpicked and put into place. There's many reasons why the administration still wants the election. One of the main ones is that almost no matter what happens in Iraq, the economic invasion is locked into place for at minimum one more year. Essentially, what the Bush administration did was, through Paul Bremer, the Coalition Provisional Authority administrator in Iraq, he implemented 100 economic orders. And you can understand these as Republicans gone wild, the most intense, crazy capitalist frenzy that they could think up, they implemented in Iraq simply because they had militarily invaded and therefore they could. They did everything that they've been trying to do at the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the NAFTA, the FTAA. You roll them up in a ball, you throw them out onto Iraq, and that is what is in place, not just what is planned, but what is actually happening. So we talk about investment rules being pulled out of the World Trade Organization, where the investment rules have all been implemented in their worst forms in Iraq. What that means in practice, and that's just one of the orders, by the way, there's 100 of them, Order number 39 is the investment rule. What that means in practice is that Iraqis cannot be preferenced in the reconstruction. So who can be preferenced in the reconstruction and who has been? U.S. corporations. Bechtel, our wonderful San Francisco-based corporation, is the second largest recipient. Halliburton, I'm sure most people know, is the number one largest recipient. But also California-based Chevron Texaco has received billions of dollars. And all of this is money that is being used, that is U.S. taxpayer money. Actually, it's Iraqi money. They haven't really touched the U.S. taxpayer money. They used all the Iraqi money to pay the U.S. corporations off, to be paid for the reconstruction. And because of the economic rules, not a cent of that money needs to stay in Iraq. Not a single Iraqi needs to be employed. Not a single penny needs to be invested to ensure that the Iraqi economy can thrive. Not a single Iraqi company needs to be hired. So what has the outcome been? U.S. corporations have gotten all the work. They've paid $100,000 to send U.S. Employees to go do the work. They are the targets of mass killings and torture, as we have seen. And not a single cent of that money has stayed in Iraq. So essentially, we are pillaging. And worse still, we're not doing any of the reconstruction. So this is one of the things that does not come out in the reports that we see every day, again, of the military advancement, is the dire, horrible state of water, electricity, healthcare, schools, roads, all the basic services. None of them are being provided, and and everything is getting worse, because now what services are being provided are, as I said, being done by U.S. companies, and so they are the targets of insurgent response. This desperate human need is what the U.S. reconstruction money, the Iraqi reconstruction money, was supposed to go to. But because of the economic policies put in place by the Bush administration, this is not happening. Another layer of the Bush administration policies in Iraq are privatization. Privatization of everything. Now, the one thing that was left off the original privatization list, however, is oil, which seems surprising because most of us, I think, are in agreement that oil was certainly one of the main targets of the invasion. The reason why it was left off of the original list was because it would be, there was enough difficult response to the privatization list. If they had put oil right there, it might have gotten things a little bit more hot than they already were. So when did they sneak in the idea of the privatization of Iraq's oil? Probably none of you know this, but on December 22nd in D.C., there was a press conference where the Iraqi finance minister met with U.S. State Department representatives and held a press conference to announce that they were discussing the privatization of Iraq's oil sector. I believe they did this to assure U.S. companies that the Iraqi government would have their back, and that the privatization would still go through regardless of what else was happening. Now, not a single news outlet covered this story except for the Interpress News Service, which not many people get. The State Department hasn't returned my calls to get the transcripts of the press conference. But this is the economic agenda that the Bush administration has applied in Iraq, but that is aggressively moving forward. It's the one thing that's really working really well in the Middle East with the Middle East Free Trade Area, which is advancing at breakneck speed. It is the expansion of all of these policies to the entire Middle East region. And this agenda is moving forward aggressively. And again, nothing in the papers. This will lock the rest of the region. The Middle East has essentially stayed insulated from free trade agreements because of oil. It hasn't needed to sign them. But now, with the threat of invasion, countries are falling over like dominoes. And the Middle East Free Trade Area is right on target to be signed by 2013, which is the target date for the Bush administration. Robert Zoellick, the main architect of the Middle East Free Trade Area, has now been promoted to the number two at State Department under Condoleezza Rice. The reason for this, I think, is to be able to more concretely link the trade policy agenda with the statecraft agenda, and to do it under Bush's most intense ally in his government, Condoleezza Rice. Robert Zoellick has been talked about in the press under this naming as a moderate who we can all trust to advance our interests in the government. Well, in addition to being the former U.S. trade representative, he also was a member of the Project for a New American Century. So he's a neoconservative. He's a neoconservative free trade hawk who's now going to be at the number two in state. There are wonderful things that we can do about this, however. I'm really glad that Medea Benjamin is sitting here, who's one of the leaders of the anti-war movement in the United States and in the world. Code Pink is doing wonderful work. Global Exchange is doing wonderful peace work. There's two things that we can do. One is the Bremer orders absolutely have to be eliminated. The Iraqis need to be given the ability to write their own economic agenda. By canceling the Bremer orders, you also put a large knife in the heart of the Middle East Free Trade Agreement and let the Bush administration know that we're watching. The second thing we can do is make sure that the reconstruction money actually goes to Iraqis to do the reconstruction, their companies, their workers, the money stays in Iraq, and that is a precondition on the money, and that the money goes directly to the Iraqis and absolutely bypasses U.S. corporate interests. Also, that the reconstruction actually happens, so that money doesn't get stuck in U.S. corporations, but actually gets onto the ground in Iraq so that it gets spent.
You've been listening to Antonia Juhas, Project Director of the International Forum on Globalization, who spoke in San Francisco January 10th at her organization's book launch.
And just a reminder, you're tuned into People's Tribune Radio.
Next, we hear from Randy Hayes, an IFG board member, founder and president of the Rainforest Action Network, and director of sustainability for the City of Oakland.
I believe really quite firmly that history will record industrial civilization as a bubble economy. Why is it that corporate-led economic globalization and industrialization will be a bubble economy? Why will it burst? It'll burst because it doesn't tell the ecological truth. Industrial economy doesn't abide by the basic principles of ecology. It doesn't tell the ecological truth, and as Vandana Shiva likes to say, that free trade is not free from ecological limits. 99% of human history, we lived essentially an ecologically sustainable way. It was before the advent of agriculture. I was recently deep in the Amazon, in the Ecuadorian Amazon, with Bill Twist, who's here tonight, to visit one of the tribes that still lives largely in that ecologically sustainable way. And this is the Ashuar tribe. The Ashuar tribe is a really unique and interesting tribe, as some of you may know, that does a lot of collective dreaming. And it's not just the dreaming, but they're putting out a really conscious drumbeat, a message to all of us these days. And that message is boiled down, not quite in their own terms, is that community-led economic localization, the way in which they live, is a superior model. It's the way in which we need to live. Community-led economic localization is essentially the antithesis of corporate-led economic globalization. So when we want to know what to do, we just take the evil empire and reverse the terminology. This corrupted American dream of growth and profit and power for the sake of yet more growth and profit and power, right, begs for a new dream. And the Ashuar tribe, and other tribes down in the Amazon, are really calling out for us to have a new dream, to dream a new dream. And to me, from a personal happiness standpoint and from a deep ecological sustainability standpoint, that mantra of community-led economic localization is a superior model is a lot to do with that dream. Now, as you all know, the house is on fire. Collectively, we as humanity have already overshot by 20%, according to recent calculations, the carrying capacity on the planet Earth, meaning the amount of land and seas that can carry the 6.4 billion people. We've already overshot from a sustainability standpoint by 20%, and we're going to go from 6.4 billion to 8 billion and perhaps to 10 billion. So we've got a real task ahead of us. 2004, just a few months ago, marked a point in human history where more people now live in urban areas than live in rural circumstances, right? And that trend will carry on. What that means is cities are the place to deliver the solutions in many respects. Can cities rise up for the kind of peaceful, nonviolent revolution we need for a livable planet? Let's hope so. But I wanted to say a little bit more about these four different systems. With the energy systems, we need to be looking at 100% renewably generated electricity and decentralized systems for energy independence. We all know that. With transportation systems, we need to be thinking, even in places like Los Angeles, where people are traveling, 70%, perhaps 90% of the time by foot or transit, mass transit or bike systems. That can be done. We can write plans to double and quadruple our mass transit systems over the next 100 years, 200 years, whatever it takes to get the job done. With our agricultural systems, we need to be talking about soil-building agricultural systems with perhaps urban gardens or maybe a radius of 100 miles outside of every major urban area in the world, producing as much as 30% or more of the food that we consume. I think we're going to need that in many parts of the planet in terms of the extreme weather events. What are extreme weather events? What we're really saying here is that the biosphere, the body of the Earth, Mother Earth, is becoming spastic, and there are spasms that break out in different places of the planet, right? Ecospasms, as some people call them. With the manufacturing system, what we're really talking about there in terms of a transformation has to do with sustainable production and consumption systems in a closed-loop material flow, a zero-waste system. Now, transformation of these four systems is not just a fantasy. We've already done a lot of these things right here in the Bay Area, and other cities around the world have done them as well. As president of the Commission on the Environment for the last 5 years and most recent year working in Oakland, we've passed in San Francisco this North America's first precautionary principle. It is now currently overriding policy for all of the activities of San Francisco that it take a precautionary approach. With Propositions B and H, we raised nearly $250 million to do energy efficiency and solar power. We are writing plans in San Francisco and Oakland to produce 50% of our electricity renewably by 2017 and 100% by 2030. We're looking at not the 7% reduction of greenhouse gases by 2012 that the Kyoto Protocol calls for, but in the Bay Area here, we're looking at 20%, and then we're developing plans to go to 70% below 1990 levels by the year 2050. That's what scientists say will help us arrest these extreme weather events. We have already achieved in San Francisco a 65% reduction of our solid waste to the landfills, and it is current policy here to go to 75% reduction by 2010, as it is in Oakland and lots of other communities and around the country. But in New Zealand, it's policy to go to zero waste by 2020. And so we took that policy, community members here in San Francisco, and said, we want that. It is now policy that by 2020 to go to zero waste here in San Francisco. And by the end of this year, 2005, we will have completed 4 hydrogen fueling stations to help us get off of this fossil fuel fix. In order to up the ante, of course, just doing it here alone is not enough. So San Francisco will host World Environment Day, the United Nations World Environment Day in 2005, June 5th, with a 5-day Green City Symposium, and we've invited the mayors of the 100 largest cities of the world to come here to share what heroic things they're doing, for us to share what we're doing, and for us together at the end of this 5-day thing on June 5th with Kofi Annan coming out here, we're going to collectively, the mayors will be signing the Urban Environmental Accords, looking at these kinds of high common denominator targets and timelines for the transformation to a better world.
The voice of Randy Hayes, Director of Sustainability for the City of Oakland, and founder and president of the Rainforest Action Network.
This is People's Tribune Radio.
Next, we hear from Anuradha Mittal of the Oakland Institute. She speaks of the first book launch about 2 years ago and the importance of the work, which she calls simply Alternatives. In her talk, she mentions Victor Minotti and Jerry Mander, two members of the IFG who were with her on the stage.
At the launch of the Alternatives first edition, in fact, I was there. I was at the podium talking about the book. And then I had talked about how it is more efficient, more pleasant for empire builders to speak not of open invasion, as they used to call it in the past, but really instead of open markets, open invasion, open markets. And that is the language that we hear today because it sounds good. You know, open invasion doesn't sound good. Open market sounds good. It is called free trade, free. Deregulation, because regulations are laws, and that's bad. It is called liberalization. But the question really is freedom for whom and for what? Rules for whom and whose rules? And I think this book, Alternatives, is really good because it answers those questions, rules for whom and who makes them. But last time at the launch of the first edition, I had taken the opportunity, since it is about alternatives, to really talk about what we can do. And at that time, we had the immoral invasion of Iraq on our hands. So I'm going to do the same this time. And to talk about the opportunity that might be presented to corporations and empire builders to go ahead with the hostile takeover of our lands and resources and sovereign will of the people. It is what I call tsunami. We have seen the attempts to undermine the United Nations and the multilateralism by the United States, Australia, Japan, and India, my home country, as they formed the self-appointed core group for relief work. It started with the shameful amount of $3.5 million that US pledged for relief, when India, which was dealing with 15,000 dead of its own, had offered $25 million to Sri Lanka. And then, shamed by the international community, United States increased that amount to $15 million, then to $35 million, and now it is $350 million pledged in aid, still shameful compared to $500 million pledged by Japan. And it is less than the funds that have been collectively pledged by Europe. And this aid is not purely humanitarian. I know we are all seeing images on television, listening to radio, and it invokes a certain kind of response. For example, thanks to Victor here, I saw an email from fisherfolk communities in Sri Lanka who are reporting that the rebuilding and rehabilitation in Sri Lanka is being totally led by investors and the World Bank with no participation from civil society. Their game plan is an accelerated tourism. And as the message from the community said, the plan is to hand over the sea and the coast to corporations and tourism, supported by military assistance from the United States. And it took so many days before the G7 could decide that all tsunami-affected countries would be eligible to have their debt payments halted. I guess even they were embarrassed that what it would look like, that the aid money which is going into these countries then turns around and is redirected to G7 as debt payment. But the question that we need to ask is, are they planning to decouple debt release from economic liberalization, or the countries have to agree to demands such as slashing safety net, public expenditure on hospitals and sanitation and schools, early warning systems. You know, my country, India, had 3 hours. Sri Lanka had 4 hours to evacuate people, and that did not happen. We have to talk about the poverty and hunger like tsunami, which is destroying lives. For example, in Africa, where almost 15,000 children die per day, as the governments are sending out $30 million each day in debt payments. In fact, on February 5th, finance ministers from G7 are meeting to consider 100% cancellation for as many as 40 of the world's poorest nations. So please visit the website of the Oakland Institute. Go to the Action Alert Center of www.oaklandinstitute.org to sign the petition for 100% debt cancellation and help win a victory on debt. So that's the little thing for alternatives, what we can do right here. So coming back to alternatives. You know, when I read the second edition, and as I told Jerry, I think it's a storyteller of the struggles around the world. Its message is very clear that people and communities are not rolling over for corporations, for international financial institutions, for empire builders to walk all over them. It tells a story, for example, November 18th, I'm going to share another story which is not in there. 400,000 coal miners, factory and transport workers, teachers, they blocked roads and highways all over Bulgaria to protest World Bank and IMF-supported government plans to phase out wage benefits and make firings of workers easier. They put down their tools so they could uphold workers' rights. We read reports on November how Bush and his APEC cronies were greeted by tens and thousands of protesters in Chile. Even the Washington Post reported a crowd estimated at 25 to 70,000 marched through downtown Santiago to protest U.S. policy in Iraq, Bush's presence in Chile, and a summit which protesters called a rich man's club. Communities that have been devastated by tsunami are coming together to both provide reconstruction, emergency relief, as well as rehabilitation. People in Uruguay voted against the privatization of water. In Pennsylvania, right here in this country, rural communities are making sure that corporate farms cannot be located in their communities. Or the Pani Panchayats in India, which are determining a different way of governance when it comes to water. In California, after Mendocino and Marin, another county, is on the march towards an anti-GE initiative. Thanks to GE Free California, advocates of also of a moratorium on GE crops, they turned in over 45,000 petition signatures on January 5th. This is another indication that people are sending a clear message that they're not about to hand over the food system to Monsanto's of the world. Syngenta has followed Monsanto and DuPont and Bayer in halting GE crop experiments in Europe. Monsanto has had to withdraw its request to release GM corn in Costa Rica and pull out of the country. So the movement of farmers via Campesina, which declared food sovereignty is a human right, which said no to GMOs, no to intellectual property rights, and trade agreements out of agriculture, it's actually beginning to happen. So all those people who said it is not a realistic idea, as Alternatives points out, it's beginning to shape. It's beginning to have a life of its own, and it's growing. So each of these different instances that I've mentioned, they're not isolated examples of dissent. They're all part of the biggest political movement of this century, which I believe has been going on for hundreds of years against slavery, against colonization of our people. This movement does not seek state power. It really just wants to take back what really belongs to the people. It's about the rebirth of democracy, real democracy, not the Western liberal concept of democracy as we know it in the United States. It's about community power, and it is about the right to commons. It is about the right to life with dignity. And this movement, after declaring, for example, Basta, the Zapatistas, it has now declared that another world is possible. This is work in progress, as our values, our goals, our policies, and strategies are being worked out. And as the book Alternatives points out, they're not being worked out in some green room in Geneva or in Washington, D.C. or Brussels, but on day-to-day basis by groups and communities and people around the world who come together with a diversity of passions and beliefs. Yes, this movement is what the Rand Corporation after Seattle had called an NGO swarm which can sting a victim to death. It is doing just that. It is stinging the so-called globalization to death. And the great thing about this book, I would say, is very often doing the work that many of us have been doing is people say, well, yeah, another world is possible, but, you know, how the hell is it possible? Alternatives actually shows how it is possible. It shows that it is not just some idealistic fantasy. It shows that it is actually rooted and grounded in real principles. For example, a Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's related covenants, such as the International Covenant on Economic and Social Human Rights. So we're not just doing some hippie talk here. This is real stuff. It is about reclaiming our commons. It is about real governance. And the great thing is, as Alternatives points out, that this work has already begun. When I read this book, what it brought up for me, it brought up what I read many years ago when Comandante Marcos had declared, and I want to share it with you. It is good for them to know, the gentlemen of money, that the times of yesterday will no longer be those of today, nor those of tomorrow. They shall no longer humiliate those of us who are the color of earth. We always had a voice, but it shall no longer be a murmur which lowers its head. It shall now be a shout which lifts the gaze and which shall force them to see us as we are and acknowledge us as we are.
You've been listening to Anuradha Mittal of the Oakland Institute, speaking in San Francisco on Monday, January 10th, about the second edition of the book, Alternatives to Economic Globalization.
That concludes this edition of People's Tribune Radio. To find out more about the International Forum on Globalization, visit their website at www.ifg.org. People's Tribune Radio is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society that nurtures the peaceful, equal, and full development of all people. To find out more about purchasing or downloading our programs, our other print and media resources, and maybe our speakers bureau, call us toll-free at 1-800-691-6888. That's 800-691-6888. Feel free to visit us online at www.lrna.org. I'm Kenny Shook, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, thanks for listening, and please tune in next time for People's Tribune Radio.